Good afternoon. Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. This past Wednesday evening, United States Senator Angus King, former United States Senator George Mitchell, and former Ambassador Nicholas Burns hosted a forum at the Portland campus of the University of Southern Maine to discuss the nuclear weapons limitation agreement with Iran. The program was free and open to the public and received overflow crowds of Mainers seeking clarity on the complex issues surrounding these historic negotiations. The forum was sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Maine, the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, and the Maine chapter of the United Nations Association, USA. This program was edited for length, and the whole program can be heard in its entirety on our website, mpbn.net, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast.
What I want to do tonight is talk about the Iran agreement with two people that have different backgrounds, but similar points of view about how to approach a question like this. George Mitchell, of course, is a lifelong negotiator. That's the name of his book, and has been involved in international negotiations, of course, in Ireland, but also in the Middle East. Nicholas Burns is a career foreign service officer who was the ambassador to Greece and was a senior State Department official during the George W. Bush administration when the Iran negotiation process really began. And I think he has an important perspective on this. So I'm going to start out with some questions, and we're going to, and can we agree, two senators and an ambassador will dispense with that, and it's George, Angus, and George, you've been a negotiator. The big underlying issue of this discussion is whatever the pluses and minuses are of the agreement, if we reject it in September, what are the alternatives and how realistic is it that we'll be able to get back to the table and get a better deal?
First, Angus, I want to thank you for organizing this conference. I think it's helpful. I think it contributes to the public debate. I think it gives people of here present, but all throughout Maine, an opportunity to hear arguments pro and con on the agreement. So I commend you for that. I also want to thank Nick for coming. Many of you may not be as aware of Nick Burns as I am. We appeared jointly several times in various venues around the country. He has a truly distinguished career in public service. He was at one point one of the highest ranking officers in the State Department. He has, since leaving there, he's been head of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and is really one of the best minds on American and world diplomacy in the country or in the world. And he has vast personal experience with dealing with Iran. So it's particularly wonderful to welcome you here, Nick. And I know all of these Maine people are grateful to you for coming up and appearing. Let me get to Angus's question, which is not only a serious one, but really the issue. I support the agreement, and if I were in the Senate, I would vote to sustain it. The president's critics and those who oppose the agreement tend to focus their arguments almost entirely on a comparison of this agreement with a perfect agreement, identifying areas where this agreement might have been better to try to reach what is a perfect agreement from our standpoint. That's a valid approach, but an equally valid approach, and perhaps one that is deserves more consideration, and one which the opponents do not address, is what are the alternatives? If you ask yourself in your own lives, in your dealing with your family, in your job, in making major decisions in life, you tend to approach any decision considering both of those factors. Could you have done better? And what are the alternatives to what I'm doing? When you buy a house, you think about alternative houses. When you buy a car, you think about alternative cars. When your child's thinking about going to college, you look at several schools. And so the analysis, I think, has to include what are the alternatives. And the alternative that flows from Angus's question is presented by some of the critics that we should resume the negotiations and get a better deal, get more included in it that is favorable to the United States. My own view is that it is highly unlikely that the negotiations could be or would be resumed. This is an agreement between six nations on our side of the table: the United States, China, Russia, France. All of them have agreed to accept the agreement, along with the executive branch of the United States government. So, and Iran, of course, is not going to be interested in renegotiating what has been for them a difficult and painful effort, particularly once they have to implement the provisions of the agreement. So my own view is that it really isn't an alternative, that it's either this agreement or no agreement. And keep in mind that the sanctions will erode whatever happens from here on out. If the agreement is approved, the sanctions will be lifted following Iran's verified completion of the steps required of it in the agreement. If the agreement is rejected by the Congress and does not go into effect, China and Russia have already made clear they will not continue or increase the sanctions, and it's almost certain that the same will be true of the other countries. The United States would retain its sanctions, but there is no history of unilateral U.S. sanctions achieving their political objectives. These sanctions have been effective precisely because they are universal, and especially that they include China and Russia. And so my view is, it's obviously speculative. I can't prove a fact that has not yet occurred, but I think there is very little, very, very little chance that negotiations would resume. And I think the choices then available to us would be far less palatable and acceptable to Americans than they are right now.
It might help to outline a little of the process and what happens from here. Congress goes back into session on the 8th of September, at which time there will be about a 9-day period between then and the required vote. Under the statute that was passed several months ago that defines how we're dealing with this question, a vote has to take place by September 17th, which is 60 days from the submission of the agreement. This is one case where Congress can't delay or duck. If they don't vote, it's deemed approved. So there has to be a vote by September 17th. It'll have to be, and there can either be a resolution of approval or a resolution of disapproval. In the House, either one of those resolutions would have to pass by a simple majority. In the Senate, either one of the resolutions, and it's likely to be a resolution of disapproval because the Republicans are opposed to the agreement, they will define, the majority leader will define what comes to the floor. That will have to pass, again, under the terms of the Corker bill by 60 votes, a resolution of disapproval. At that point, if a resolution of disapproval is passed, it's pretty clear that the president will veto it. At that point, then the bill comes back first to the House, where it would have to be overridden by 2/3, and then to the Senate. If it's sustained in the House, it would never get to the Senate. If the House overrides the veto, it would come to the Senate, and the proponents of the disapproval would have to have 67 votes. So that's the sort of path that we're on in terms of how this will be considered. I want to ask Nick. First, I think, Nick, could you give us... Everybody talks about this as Obama and the Ayatollah, and that this deal is us and them, and it's a recent invention of this administration. Give me some history.
Be happy to. And first, let me just say thank you to Senator King for the invitation to be here in Portland. I'm a great admirer of his service and his leadership on behalf of your state in Washington. I've had the benefit of visiting with him a couple of weeks ago in his office, and I can tell you his voice is being heard on this issue because he's delved into every detail of it. So I'm a great admirer of Senator King and thank him. I've learned a lot from Senator Mitchell over the years, and as a young diplomat, and watched him as an aspiring negotiator, watched him and had great admiration for the Good Friday Agreement. He brought peace to Northern Ireland, for what he did in the Middle East, for what he did in the Senate as majority leader. He is such a good friend to me that he promoted me today. I'm not the head of the Kennedy School. I'm just a professor. But I'm a lowly professor. But I appreciate the sentiment. And I also wanted to say
it's a hint to the board of Harvard.
I'm here today with my wife, Libby. We had a great afternoon here. We were on Exchange Street, 4th Street, Commercial Street. Had a great lunch and visited your beautiful art museum.
You didn't go to the most inappropriately named town in America? Freeport.
So here is what we've been trying to do. I served as a career diplomat in the George W. Bush administration. I served in every administration from Jimmy Carter to George W. Bush. And in 2006, we were occupying Iraq, and it wasn't going well. And we were occupying Afghanistan, and it was heavy duty. And President Bush made the decision that he was not going to take military action against Iran at that point on this nuclear question. He was going to seek negotiations. My job working for Condoleezza Rice was to try to get to negotiations. We formed the group that Senator Mitchell talked about with Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. He said, we'll negotiate together. We'll offer negotiations. The Iranians turned us down twice in 2006 and 2007. We then went to sanctions against them. And we sanctioned the Iranian regime until President Obama came in. And you think of a relay race, which is what our presidential transitions are. President Bush finished. He gave the baton to President Obama. President Obama has run forward with it. We've had two administrations trying to stop Iran through negotiations. President Obama got to the table 2 years ago, and the result is this agreement. I look at it this way, Angus. It's not a perfect agreement, as Senator Mitchell said. It has real benefits for the United States. And I think our negotiators, led by Secretary Kerry, did a good job. They actually got more than I thought they would get. It has some downside risks, like any compromise agreement. Where I come out is that I think the benefits of this agreement outweigh the risks. I support the deal, and I hope that the Senate, if it disapproves it, I hope that President Obama's veto is going to be sustained and we implement it. And I support it because of the following, Angus. We're going to stop Iran's forward movement towards a nuclear weapon. That's what this deal does. It freezes their program for 10 to 15 years. It places them under 25 years of unprecedented International Atomic Energy Agency inspections, soup to nuts. The only two ways to a nuclear weapon is you mine, convert, mill, and enrich uranium and produce weapons-grade uranium, or through the plutonium process, through a heavy water reactor. That's the other way. This deal shuts them both down. And so for 10 or 15 years, I think we can be assured Iran will not have a nuclear weapon and will be subject to these inspections.
But one of the weaknesses is it is only 10 or 15 years.
That's the weakness. The weakness is that about year 15, these restrictions all lapse, and Iran can return to a civil nuclear program to produce energy. They could possibly use that in a covert way to produce a military facility to become a nuclear weapons power. But my view is that President Obama has not given away the options that not his successor would have, but his successor's successor will have 15 years from now. If the Iranians tried to break out towards a nuclear weapon, that president, he or she, could use military force to stop the Iranians, could reimpose a global sanctions coalition on them. So I don't think we've given away our future flexibility to defend our national interests, and I think that's one of the big reasons why I support it.
Well, let me run down some of the objections, and I've sat through many, many hearings, so I'm channeling Tom Cotton now, or John McCain, or Lindsey Graham. The 24 days.
Yeah.
I think it's important to make clear that we do have anytime, anywhere inspection of known nuclear facilities. What we don't have is anytime, anywhere inspection of unknown facilities, covert facilities, and there's a process that gives us access to those, but it could take as long as 24 days. And some people have said, well, if you give a drug dealer 24 days, he'll flush all the bad stuff down the toilet. What's the answer to that?
Well, the answer is that I think the opponents of the deal have tried to convince Americans that somehow the 24 days is the entirety of the inspections regime. And the reality is, and I had the benefit of talking to Secretary Ernie Moniz, a New Englander originally from Fall River, very impressive guy, and he said, we're going to put the most intensive inspections ever on the existing facilities. And I think that's the first way to answer your question, Angus. We'll have cameras inside all the known existing facilities, the Natanz and Four Dow uranium plants, the Arak heavy water reactor. We will see if they're cheating. The 24 days is an entirely different situation. If at some point along the continuum, the Iranians develop a secret facility, and they may do it because they've lied about their program in the past consistently to the United Nations, and if we believe we've seen evidence that they have a secret facility, then this 24-day process kicks in, where the United States brings a complaint to the IAEA, the Iranians respond to it back and forth for 24 days. At that point, if we think they have a secret facility, we're going to walk away from the agreement. The agreement's going to be broken. They'll have fundamentally violated it. So I'm not as exercised about the 24 days as I am about the routine inspections that are in place.
Well, the other piece, we're lucky that at this particular moment in time, we had a Secretary of Energy who is a genuine nuclear physicist. Yeah. And as he's pointed out several times, this stuff has a half-life of 700 million years. 24 days is a blink of an eye in terms of finding fissile material, which now, I think to be fair, they could have a covert facility that would work on triggers or on computer programs or those kinds of things, and those things probably could be hidden. But ultimately, to create a bomb, you need nuclear material, and that can't be hidden even after 24 days, and Secretary Moniz has been pretty emphatic about that. The 15 years we've talked about, $56 billion. You hear a lot of numbers about how much money will be released to the Iranians if the deal goes through. The generally accepted figure is $56 billion. $150 billion, but most of that is already committed. It's money the Iranians owe the Chinese, so it's going to end up back in the hands of the Chinese. It's not going to go back to the Iranians. But $56 billion is a lot of money. And one of the arguments is, Ted Cruz said, Obama's the biggest funder of terrorism in the history of the world. Because I heard him say it. I was in the committee. And because of this $56 billion, which would be made available to Iran, that they could turn to nefarious purposes. George, what's the answer?
Well, that is a risk. This is not a risk-free agreement. But the reality is that because the sanctions are going to erode, whether the agreement is implemented or not, Iran is going to be able to resume selling oil on the international market and will have substantial additional revenues. So they're going to have more money than they now have in any event, even if this $56 billion didn't exist. So to me, it's a question of their decision on what they're going to use it for. I think it's likely, and we have to anticipate, that they will clearly continue the activities in which they are engaging in helping those who support their cause. Because remember, we're dealing with an issue now that didn't begin last year, last decade, or last century. Iran, as the leading Shia-dominated nation,
Persian Shia-dominated
nation, is in a long-standing conflict with the Arab nations, who are Sunni-dominated, that goes all the way back to the 7th century and the death of the Prophet Muhammad. The Sunni-Shia split was not religious in nature. It was a political struggle for power. When the Prophet Muhammad died, two factions formed to try to gain control of the empire that had been created. One were his blood relatives, who lost and became the Shia. The other was what we would call the bureaucracy that had been built up around him, non-relatives, who prevailed and became the Sunni. And for 1,400 years, they have been in a competition. It periodically goes into remission, has gone into remission, and then it flares. And it's at a peak of intensity now. You see it in Iran. You see in Iran versus Saudi Arabia. You see it within Iraq, within Syria, within Yemen. It's very violent within Pakistan and many other countries in the region. That's going to continue, and Iran is going to continue to be a leader of those Muslims who are Shia, and they will be contested by the Muslims who are Sunni.
Ironically, and one of Iran's greatest enemies is ISIS.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. I should be clear. There are many internal conflicts now creating turbulence within Islam. It's not just Sunni versus Shia. There are internal conflicts within Sunni Muslim. There are offshoots. The Alawite sect in Syria is an offshoot of Shiism, but it's different in some respects. So the conflicts are many. They're confusing. They're sometimes contradictory. That's going to continue. And there's nothing we can do or say to prevent that conflict from continuing and Iran from continuing to exercise its influence in that area. The question is, you can't solve every problem in one fell swoop. And so should you say, because we can't solve everything in one agreement, we shouldn't solve anything? To me, it makes sense to deal with Iran's nuclear weapon. No matter what else happens, their acquiring a nuclear weapon would greatly magnify their influence in the region, would touch off an arms race in that region for absolutely certain, and therefore would likely end the restraint in the dissemination of nuclear weapons that has existed for nearly seven centuries under the leadership of the United States. Everybody keep in mind, there are many, many countries in the world who have the capability or who could quickly acquire the capability to produce a nuclear weapon. Only 9 have done so. The vast majority voluntarily refrain from doing so in reliance upon the United States and the nuclear nonproliferation regime and acting in what they believe to be their self-interest. And so I think this is going to continue with Iran. I think we've done a good job in nonproliferation over the past 70 years. And if we can prevent them from getting a weapon, we would have accomplished something very good, although we will not have solved every problem in the world or even in the Middle East.
Nick, you said something that the U.S. should take the nuclear weapons off the table, but that's not the end of the story with Iran.
Right. And just to build on what Senator Mitchell has said, as this nuclear deal goes forward, and I hope it goes forward, President Obama, his successor, and that person's successor are going to have to try to contain Iranian power for the reasons that Senator Mitchell suggested. The Iranians, the big Shia power in the world, are making a major push for power in the heart of the Sunni world. So if you think of your map, they're arming the Houthi rebels in Yemen. They've instigated a civil war there. They're the kingmaker in Syria. They are the kingmaker and arming the Shia rebels in the southern part of Iraq that are a big problem and were for our troops there. And they're arming Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. So I hope when this nuclear deal goes forward, President Obama will go back to the Congress, and I hope that Republicans and Democrats and independents can agree on this. We ought to make clear to the Iranians that we will use force against them if they get close to a nuclear weapon. We ought to be renegotiating our defense agreement with Israel to strengthen Israel, because the Iranians won't attack Israel, but they'll use their proxy groups, Hezbollah and Hamas, to attack Israel. And we ought to be trying to, as Senator Mitchell said, strengthen the Arab countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman,
because they're the frontline states against Iran. So a containment regime to kind of push back against Iranian power as this nuclear deal goes forward. So I don't see some of the opponents of President Obama have said this is a sign of weakness, this agreement. I think it's a smart agreement. As long as it's coupled with a smart policy to try to contain Iranian power, then I think we'll be serving our national interest.
Well, I heard somebody say the only thing worse than a rogue Iran with $56 billion to spend is a rogue Iran with $56 billion to spend and a nuclear weapon.
That's right.
Right.
And,
right.
And that's really right. What we're discussing here.
Right.
I was on the radio this morning, always fun, and everything was going swimmingly until the last question when the interviewer, who shall remain nameless, Mike, Mike said, "But Senator, what about the hostages?" And I started to answer, and he said, "Well, you liberals in the Senate don't care about the hostages." And I started to answer again, and he said, "We're out of time." But I think the answer I would have given, which I think is very relevant, because people say, I've heard Senator Rubio on the floor of the Senate say, this agreement should recognize Israel's right to exist, it should release the hostages, it should forswear support for terrorism, and you know, a couple of other things. That's not what this negotiation was all about. The sanctions were imposed specifically to deal with the nuclear issue. And as I thought about this, I'm old enough to remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. And when President Kennedy was negotiating to get the missiles out of Cuba, he didn't say, oh, by the way, we'd also like you to depose Castro and for Russia, it was the Soviet Union, to forswear communism. And by the way, the Soviet Union at that time was saying, we will bury you. This wasn't an academic, nice guy kind of thing. But he said, the issue here is the missiles. It wasn't the other things. And I'd love to get the hostages out, and I think that's another level of negotiation, but that I think it's important to emphasize that that wasn't what this negotiation was about, and to try to load those things onto it is basically, I think, you're the diplomat, ensuring failure of the negotiation.
Well, President Obama had to make a big decision about 2 years ago when these negotiations started. Are they going to be about everything? Because we haven't talked to the Iranians in 35 years since they took our hostages. A lot of people remember that, the older people like me, 79. And I think he made a correct decision, but we've all been in negotiations. We have to establish what's the framework. President Obama felt if it's about everything, maybe the Iranians have more leverage on us than we want them to have. If it's only about nuclear weapons, which is what the negotiations were about, we've got the leverage because they're the ones who violated international law, and we can bring international pressure to bear. I think it was the right decision. Does the president care about the American hostages? Of course he does. I think you'll see enormous American pressure now that we do have a relationship on Iran to see them released.
If they were smart, they'd release them.
Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post reporter who's been in prison for a year, his wife and mother are able to visit him in Evran prison this morning. His case is coming up in the next week. If the Iranians are as smart as I think they may be, cagey, they're going to. I hope they'll release him. If they don't, I hope we'll have tremendous pressure on them from all around the world to release him. Robert Levinson, former FBI agent, was gone missing in 2007. The Iranians have never satisfactorily said what happened to him, so we should be bringing this pressure to bear. But if it's permissible for me, Angus, I'd like to ask you a question. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. So you're the
Everybody
only one...
Everybody else does now.
You're the only one on this stage, I think, who's going to vote on September 17th or by then in the Senate. Senator Mitchell had that privilege for many decades in the Senate. And I know that I talked to you at least twice before you made your announcement that you were supporting the deal. I know how deeply immersed you've been in this. What was your calculation? How did you see the risk-benefit calculus, and what brought you to your decision?
Well, I brought my copy of the agreement with me. Here's how I approached it. I started with reading the agreement. It drove me crazy. I got to tell you that people were announcing their opposition to the agreement before they'd even seen it, let alone read it. I mean, on something this important, I just didn't get that. One or two people may have announced support, but the vast majority of people who came out literally the morning of the agreement were saying, I'm against it. This is bad, terrible, it's a sellout and everything else. And I was wondering, how do they know? So I started with reading the agreement, and
read it two or three times, and then marked in the margin. And Steve Smith from my office is up in the back. He can tell you he then had the task of dealing with all my questions. And we just went through one at a time. And then I started going to hearings. And actually, I got some notoriety for, in fact, no, you weren't there. I'm not a member of the Foreign Relations Committee. I'm a member of the Armed Services and Intelligence Committee, and we had hearings. But Foreign Relations was the big committee dealing with this, and they were having a big hearing with Secretary Kerry, Ernie Moniz, Secretary Liu. So I went and sat in the cheap seats and just listened and, didn't get to ask questions. I wasn't on the panel or anything. And so what I've done is just try to immerse myself in this and then reach out to people like you and arms control negotiators, military people, retired military people, everybody I can think of, some that I can name and others that asked me not to name, but to just get a variety of views. I gave my position away in my first question. I ultimately ended up with a long list of flaws in the agreement, but then ended up trying to think of what would the alternative be. And where I ended up was, if we don't do this, if the Congress walks away, it's clear that the sanctions regime which brought Iran to the table is going to, I'll use the word, fray, erode. Nobody can argue it will disappear overnight, but it will definitely weaken. As George said, mostly China and Russia is certainly going to head for the exits. Business delegations are already in Tehran from Germany, France, and Great Britain. So it's clear that the sanctions are going to diminish. So I was concerned that we'd be left with the worst of all worlds, a weaker sanctions regime and an Iran unfettered by the agreement. And so that was how I ended up making the decision that I did to support it. Not that it's a terrific agreement, but you cannot analyze this simply by reading this. You have to say, compared to what? And the what strikes me as Iran, we know today, is within 2 or 3 months of enough physical material to make a bomb. And this puts them back to a year and under the most severe inspections ever, anywhere. For 10 to 15 years, and it's really more like 15 years, and severe limitations on what they can have in the way of how enriched the uranium can be, how many pounds it can be. It's in kilograms, but I still think 2.2 pounds. And I determined that the agreement with all its flaws was better than the consequences of not doing it. Now, the president has gotten some criticism, and I think, frankly, somewhat justified for the speech that he made that basically said the choice is the agreement or war. It's not that simple. But if you follow it through, it's pretty close, because clearly there would be an effort to keep the sanctions regime in place, but if the sanctions regime starts to erode and Iran starts to go for a bomb, you're left with a military option. And the military experts have told me that a strike which wiped out Iran's current nuclear infrastructure would set them back between 2 and 3 years. Not forever, between 2 and 3 years. And I can't help but think, if we bomb them, after 2 or 3 years, are they going to want to negotiate with us? I don't think so. One of my colleagues, again, Senator Cotton, said this will be a 2 or 3 day war.
Just like Afghanistan and Iraq.
The only thing you know about war is that you don't know what's going to happen, that the results are unpredictable. So I don't think it's quite that stark, but I think the logical steps are there that make it a very serious decision. This wasn't easy for me. This is the hardest public policy decision I've ever had to make, and it's 52-48. I'm not arguing that it's, by golly, I have the only answer. This was a close call. But that's where I came out, and that was sort of the process. And it's This is the other piece I should mention is we have assets other than the IAEA to inspect. People think about, okay, the inspection is by this international organization. They're not going to be any Americans. Can we really trust them? The truth is there are going to be at least 6 intelligence agencies from all over the world watching this. And I don't want to be one of those guys that say, trust me, I'm on the intelligence committee, but we have pretty good knowledge of what's going on. And so it's the IAEA plus the intelligence community of the P5 plus one, plus Israel, and who knows who else. So there'll be a lot of information about what's going on. Is it impossible for him to cheat? Nothing's impossible. But I think it's very unlikely. And I can tell you, without revealing anything classified, our intelligence community, which is 17 different agencies, did an assessment of the deal. It was required by the Corker bill. It's a classified document. And I can't tell you what's in it, except I can tell you I was very reassured when I read it. It's a very strong statement that is reassuring to those of us that are concerned about verification. The final thing, and I promised not to make a speech, but the final thing is one of my principles of life is implementation is as important as vision. If we don't pay attention to the implementation of this, to the verification, the next 2 presidents and the next 8 Congresses, it's not going to work. It could be a perfect agreement. It won't work. It has to be implemented and executed in a way that it protects our interests. So I think that's something I intend to pay attention to on the next day after the dust settles.
Angus, could I make a digress to another point? In our country today, there is widespread alienation from our government, disconcerting to all of us. But what we ought to keep in mind is that the gap between the people and the government is substantial in most societies. Perhaps none more so than in societies which are totalitarian in nature or which don't preach or practice democratic norms to which we've become accustomed. We've spoken here tonight, and this is discussed all over our country, as the Iranians. But we ought to be clear that the government of Iran does not effectively represent all of the people of Iran. Bellicose statements made by the successive leaders of recent governments do not represent the feelings of all of the 80 million people of Iran, and arguably of not a very large number of them. I just yesterday, up on Mount Desert Island, spoke with a retired U.S. diplomat who just came back from a 10-day trip to Iran, a private trip with former U.S. diplomats. And I said, how was it? He said, I never met a bunch of more pro-Americans than the people on the streets over there. They despise the regime. They're very hostile to the regime. The regime had to manipulate the last election. They couldn't win a fair, free, democratic election. And so I don't think we should rule out, I don't think we should bank on or bet on, but I don't think we should rule out the possibility of evolution within that country and within that society. There are, in Southern California alone, 600,000 Iranian Americans. And I, echoing the statement of the fellow I just quoted, I never met a bunch of more patriotic Americans than the Iranian Americans who've tasted this kind of government and now, like many, many others, in fact, some distant ancestor of everybody in this room, came from somewhere else, mostly because they wanted freedom and opportunity, and they found it here. So I think we ought to keep in mind that the possibility of evolution, of a change in government, of a change in system, of giving the people there what people everywhere want, despite the differences in religion and language and color and ethnicity. People want a decent job, a decent home, a safe and secure society, and most of all, a place where they can get their kids off to a good start in life. And that's a possible byproduct of this. We don't mean we drop our guard. It doesn't mean we don't outspokenly oppose the policies of the Iranian government, call them on when they're wrong and when they make false statements, as they repeatedly have. But also keep in mind that there are other possibilities that could flow from this.
Nick, I just thought of a better answer when you asked me how I came to my decision.
Yeah.
Since I sit in George's seat, I should have said, what would George do? that would have been an easy way to make the decision.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you.
Angus? Go ahead, Nick.
I just wanted to add one thing that hasn't come up yet. When I served in the Foreign Service as a civil servant, of course, we were neutral politically, never chose party allegiances, and so this is where this comment is coming from. I've testified 4 times before Congress in the last 30 days, 3 Senate committees, 1 House committee. There is no debate in the Republican Party about this agreement. I'm not sure of the several hundred Republicans in the House and Senate, more than a handful, if that, vote with the president. The debate's in the Democratic Party. That disturbs me as a citizen. Because Senator King said, this is the most important public policy, most difficult decision that you've faced. I've talked to a lot of members who say, probably the most important vote they say I'm going to make in my political career. And if the stakes are that high, if ultimately it's about war or peace with Iran, the fact that there's no debate in one party, that they're entirely opposed, I find highly disturbing. And I want to say something positive about President Obama, because there's been so much criticism of him. And I've been very supportive of him as president, but not uncritical on many foreign policy issues. He has immersed himself in this deal. If you look at his press conferences and speeches, he really understands this. Very smart man. I think he's made the calculations that the benefits are there for us. If there's a risk, we can account for the risk, as we've all talked about. The Iranians are not 10 feet tall. We are. We're so much more powerful than they are that if the deal fails, we still retain the upper hand in the struggle with the Iranians, which is another reason I think the criticism is off base, that somehow President Obama has misled the country or is leading us down a path to failure. That's what the criticism is, and I think that is so exaggerated. And in an issue of this consequence, we ought to have a complex debate, not a simplistic one. I just wanted to offer that.
Well, Angus said several senators came out right after it was announced before reading it. The fact is, a very large number announced against the agreement before there was an agreement. Yeah. Long before there was an agreement. Yeah. They said, we're against the agreement, an agreement, any agreement. How can you have a debate on that basis?
Well, I think we may. This is a preview. I've talked to Leader McConnell. We may see an actual Senate debate, like in the movies, where the senators are all in their seats and they stand up and actually debate. I don't know those of you that, if you're having trouble sleeping, you may watch C-SPAN from time to time. But you'll see it's this very, it's been the oddest thing for me, because you go to the Senate floor and you're all fired up to make a speech. You stand up and make the speech. There's nobody there except for the presiding officer. And you hope that they'll listen, that one person. And then you fold up your papers, go back to your office, and somebody else comes down and makes another speech. It's like ships passing in the night. I suggested to Mitch McConnell that we have, I said, the nation's attention is going to be focused on this. Let's have a real debate and put everybody in their chairs and have a real debate and vote yay or nay from our seat. So he seemed to like the idea, but we'll see. But I'm hoping that will be the case. I think it'll be illuminating. I don't think it's going to change many minds. But I have been in the chamber where I've heard people make speeches that would have changed minds if anybody had been there to hear them. And so, you know, I'm hoping that that's the way it's going to happen. I know many of you were given cards as you came in, so now's the time to pass them down to the end of the row and get them up to our professor, and he's going to put questions. I've told him to don't filter out the hard ones.
Okay, here's one question. If the sanctions from other countries will fritter away, why doesn't Iran just wait it out?
We were able to do over the last 2 or 3 years was bring the entire world against Iran. So the United Nations passed 4 Security Council resolutions that required every country in the world to sanction Iran. As Senator Mitchell has suggested, you can only hold 195 countries together for so long. So one of the tactical calculations in these negotiations is when do you end this agreement because you think your pressure is maximal. And I think the president calculated he couldn't hold. And the Europeans couldn't hold the coalition together forever. We got the best deal we could at the time. If we walked away, and this is where we started with Senator King's leadership, if we walk away, and most of the senators and representatives to whom I've spoken who are against the deal say, walk away, sanction Iran, we'll keep our coalition together.
No deal.
Wait for a better deal. I think 3 things would happen. Number 1, global unity would fray, erode, diminish. The Indians and Japanese would go back to trading with Iran. Number 2, the sanctions regime would erode, and that's our leverage. And number 3, and a lot of the opponents don't want to admit this, all the current restrictions on Iran from the deal that will freeze their program for 10 to 15 years, they'll evaporate. The Iranians will be free to rebuild their program. I think that no deal, what the opponents of the deal say, walk away, it strengthens Iran and it weakens the United States. As I go through the logic train as a former diplomat thinking about this.
The conventional wisdom is that the president has the Senate votes he needs to sustain his veto. Do you agree with that assessment?
I don't have any special insight in terms of counts. The president needs 34 votes, although my preference would be that there be 41 votes so that the resolution of disapproval wasn't approved, did not get the required 60 votes, rather than simply win by sustaining a veto. I just think that would be a better statement. I don't have the ads started here in Maine yet. Have there been ads on TV? I know I was on the internet last night looking up, you know, the Red Sox or something, and up popped a banner that said, "Call Senator King." I'm not making this up. And sure enough, 15 minutes later, my phone rang. It was Mary. You know, she said she told me to call. So there is going to be a lot of pressure. I think there are maybe a dozen or so Democrats who haven't announced their position yet, and the president could lose 12. There are already 2 announced in opposition, Chuck Schumer and Bob Menendez. So it's going to be pretty intense, I think, over the next several weeks. A lot of pressure. I've heard various figures, 40 million, 60 million being spent on a campaign to bring pressure on those 10 or so senators. So I don't think it's an entirely predictable outcome right now.
How does one counter the argument that Iran's R&D, research and development program, could advance freely during the 15-year period without violating the agreement?
Well, the Iranians are going to be restricted in developing the most powerful centrifuges in the uranium process for the next 8 to 10 years. It is true, and here's the downside risk, that after 15 years, the Iranians could build into their uranium processing plants what they call IR-6, IR-7, IR-8 centrifuges. So you could more rapidly accelerate the production of fissile material, which is a necessary ingredient for a bomb. That's the downside risk. But if they do that, they'll be in clear violation of this agreement. They have promised in this agreement, we can't trust their promises, but they have promised not to develop a nuclear weapon. So if we see them 15 years from now engaged in introducing these centrifuges into their uranium plants, it's a clear violation. President Obama's successor, he or she, will be able to form a sanctions coalition to punish them, use military force if necessary to do what Senator King said, knock them back by a couple of years. So we haven't given up any options here, and that would be a clear violation.
Well, one way to look at it that I've thought of, and it's not exact, but we have roughly the same options in 15 years, but we've bought 15 years.
Right. Right. I mean, exactly.
I have here, I'm going to combine two that share a theme. As one presidential candidate has said, quote, if the deal is passed, I'll rip up the agreement. Is that possible? How can changes be made to ensure that future presidents do not strip or repeal this deal?
I think it'd be very difficult for, just as I think it's going to be very difficult to repeal Obamacare in light of the Supreme Court decision. Mm-hmm. In international diplomacy, you know, when our presidents of either party make agreements and put the name of the United States on an agreement, it's very difficult for the successor to say, I'm going to rip it up, because what's the cost to us? Our best friends are part of this agreement, Britain, France, and Germany. We've made commitments to the United Nations Security Council. We will be far down the road, and why would we rip up an agreement on January 20th, 2017, if one of those people is president of the United States, which is a big if? When the Iranians, their program will be frozen. If we rip the agreement up, all the restrictions are lifted from Iran. So I don't see the logic. I don't think it's politically or diplomatically possible or desirable.
Yeah. The next question, what is the political or legislative process that Iran goes through in terms of approving or voting down this treaty?
I'll take a stab at that. They have a parliament called the Majlis, mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, I think their process is they're going to take a vote on it 90 days after the agreement. U.S. Congress vote is 60 days. So they have to vote on it and approve it. I think the assumption is that if it's approved by the leadership, it's going to be approved by the parliament. My guess is if we reject it, they would probably go through some formal process of rejecting it as well. But that's their political process. But the question is whether their parliament is as independent of the executive as ours is, mm-hmm. Which is pretty bloody independent.
Thank you.
I'd like to comment, Angus, on a point that was raised earlier that I didn't have a chance to speak about, and that's this argument that a lot of issues are left on the table, and it most commonly comes in the form of support to Hezbollah and Hamas and others. The issue of the hostages was raised. This is a common occurrence in every agreement ending conflicts. And it resonates very deeply with me personally because of my experience in Northern Ireland. We reached an agreement that ended a conflict that had been going on arguably for 800 years. It was a brutal conflict. It was imperfect. It didn't address every subject. And some of what it did address was highly emotional, confrontational. Included in the Northern Ireland Peace Agreement was a provision establishing a process for the early release of so-called prisoners on both sides, men and a few women on both sides who'd been convicted, many of them, of murder. Bombings, assassinations, the most violent of attempts. Those involved in the conflict thought of themselves as patriotic defenders of their society. They liked, in talking to me, to compare themselves to George Washington's army at Valley Forge. But to the families whose husbands and sons and wives had been murdered, had been subject of these most violent and reprehensible acts, it was outrageous that a process should be established for their early release from prison. The agreement was not self-implementing. It had to be approved in a referendum by voters separately in both Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. So the governments of Britain and Ireland asked me to return to campaign for the agreement, and they asked me especially to meet with the victims, families of the survivors, the wives whose husbands had been killed, the husbands whose children had been killed, and to try to urge them to support the agreement. And I spent I had a lot of very, very difficult meetings. I don't think I persuaded any one of them. But the point I made to them is that no one can ever, ever satisfy your grief. It's something that's happened. It can't be changed. Your son, your husband, your daughter is gone. And I can understand your feelings of hostility to a process whereby the murderer of your family is going to get out of prison early. The only thing I can say to you is that if this agreement goes forward, there'll be fewer people going through in the future what you went through. If the agreement does not go through, what's happened to you will happen to many, many others. No agreement can solve completely for all time every issue. It is the classic example of the perfect being the enemy of the good to say this agreement with Iran should not be approved because it doesn't solve problem A, B, C, and D, even though it addresses a critical issue. We're all human, we're all fallible. We have to take a positive step when and where we can. And a step that prevents Iran from getting a nuclear weapon for at least 15 years and maybe forever, while holding out all other options, seems to me to be so clearly in the national interest that I hope and pray that enough of our legislators, our senators and our members of Congress, display the kind of wisdom and judgment and courage that Senator King has displayed. He read it, he analyzed it, he thought it through carefully, and he's making the decision he thinks is in the best interest of the people of this state and this country. And let's hope there are enough others who have the same approach, attitude, and decision. Thank you all.
Thank you all for coming.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. On today's program, United States Senator Angus King, former United States Senator George Mitchell, and former Ambassador Nicholas Burns hosted a forum at the Portland campus of the University of Southern Maine to discuss the Nuclear Weapons Limitation Agreement with Iran. This program was edited for length, and the entire program can be heard on our website, mpbn.net, where Speaking in Maine is also available for streaming and as a podcast. Charles Beck is the executive producer for Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward.